Welcome to this audio issue of Porter Stansberry's Complete Investor, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. This issue was originally published on November 20, 2025. Not bad for government bonds. A positively asymmetric risk versus reward setup. A safe play that still has big potential upside. Creak, creak, creak. In the windowless room in the basement of Castle Weissenstein, the 12-foot-tall, mysteriously shrouded wheel began to turn. The door slammed shut. Ceremoniously, Prince Karl of Hesse-Cassel sealed the lock with hot wax and posted a guard. 1 month later, on January 4, 1718, the seal crumbled. The door swung open. And there stood the oilcloth-wrapped wheel, without a motor, without an attendant, still revolving, at exactly the same speed. Apparently, Johann Bessler had been telling the truth. He had invented the world's first genuine perpetual motion machine, or so it seemed. Bessler, an itinerant watchmaker from Zittau, Germany, claimed he'd harnessed gravity to create a source of unlimited energy. In a world that still thought of alchemy as a respectable science, this wasn't as far-fetched as it sounds today. And, for a while, anyway, Bessler had the biggest brains in Europe to back him up: Dutch mathematician Willems Gravesande, British instrument maker John Rowley, and German polymath Gottfried Leibniz, who helped invent calculus, all attended demonstrations and believed the wheel was real. Bessler himself was more showman than scientist. Feeling that his name lacked panache, he created a cipher that transposed Bessler into the much more exotic-sounding Orpheus, and took his wheel on tour under that stage name. He debuted a 6-foot wheel at Leipzig in 1712, a 12-footer at Merseburg, and, finally, pulled off his locked-room castle stunt at Hesse-Cassel in 1718. His carny tendencies naturally went hand-in-hand with a bit of grifting. He blanketed the continent with sensational pamphlets, attempting to drum up financial support. He charged general admission to curious onlookers, and he offered a peek behind the oilcloth curtain for the low, low price of £10,000 a person. Surprisingly, no one took him up on the offer. By 1720, Bessler's wheel had garnered international notoriety, but not much cash. The most he'd been able to score was a paltry patronage from Prince Karl of Hesse-Cassel. The next step was clearly, what else? A full-fledged IPO. Or, what passed for an IPO in those days? Launching a stock in 18th-century Europe was simple, if you had a personal in with the king, and could persuade him to issue you a license to operate as a corporate entity, known as a charter. When the king chartered a company, he granted it legal right to exist, and also granted himself the royal right to skim money out of its coffers should the royal exchequer require it. As is ever the case with big government, the process of gaining a charter, which included a lengthy, expensive application process and often an act of legislation, was fraught with difficulty. After all, with each new royal corporation, the king was effectively vetting and commissioning a private bank for himself. Only the few, the brave, the very solvent scored a charter. Which left a lot of smaller concerns, like Bessler's strapped for cash perpetual motion enterprise, out in the cold. Unless they launched an unchartered company, that is, unchartered waters. Businesses without a royal charter, known as unincorporated joint stock companies, sidestepped dealing with the king and his rules altogether. They just issued their own stock, wrote their own bylaws, and kept whatever money they made for themselves. Of course, like any enterprise with zero guardrails, this could and did backfire. Particularly for shareholders. Johann Bessler, never a fan of guardrails, clearly felt more comfortable with option B. In 1720, as moneyed patrons for Bessler's invention continued to be elusive, an ad enticing investors to back an unincorporated joint stock enterprise for a wheel for perpetual motion appeared in English papers, likely helped along by London instrument maker and Bessler fan John Rowley. But sadly, the new perpetual motion stock, along with a host of other small businesses, like one to make salt water fresh and one for importing jackasses from Spain, never had a chance to get off the ground, let alone return fabulous riches for early investors. In those days, England's biggest royally chartered company was the South Sea Company, created by an Act of Parliament in 1711. Ostensibly, its mission was to trade with Spanish colonies, but really, it served as a giant slush fund to replenish the royal coffers after an expensive war. Unchartered companies, no matter how tiny, siphoned bits of money away from the government's massive South Sea shell game, and by the 1710s, unchartered stocks were rapidly growing in popularity. So in June 1720, Parliament passed the Bubble Act, which outlawed all incorporated joint stock companies as a public nuisance, due to their crime of conducting business for their own private lucre, the horror. Ironically, the South Sea Company itself proved to be the biggest bubble of all. It collapsed spectacularly in September, just a few months after the Bubble Act outlawed unincorporated stocks, so much for the relative stability of government-run enterprises. As for Johann Bessler, he soon found himself not just a public nuisance, but a pariah. In 1727, his former maidservant, Anne Mauersbergerin, came forward and testified that she'd been the one to turn the wheel via a hidden crank. Disgraced in the eyes of the scientific community, Bessler abandoned his wheel and retreated to a secluded farm, where he busied himself inventing a perpetual motion windmill. There was clearly ill luck blowing from some quarter of the compass. In 1745, Johann Bessler toppled into his own windmill and died, leaving more questions than answers. Bessler's perpetual motion grift ground to a halt. Surprisingly, though, it wasn't the end of the road for unincorporated joint stock companies. Trust, but verify. Today, royal charters have largely gone the way of the little skirts Victorians used to put around chair legs. Interestingly, the Crown-funded British Broadcasting Corporation, BBC, remains one of the last fully government-chartered English companies existing today. The unincorporated joint stock company, however, took on a robust second life of its own. Under the punitive terms of the Bubble Act, a slew of companies folded, or sought their fortunes elsewhere. By the late 1700s, the unincorporated structure made its way, surprise, to the uninhibited New World, where it became enshrined in American law as a form of company called the Massachusetts Trust. Described in the American Bar Association Journal in 1923 as the mysterious Massachusetts Trust, with features that straddle the line between corporation and partnership, it offered a way to pool resources and invest without taxes, and became a popular vehicle for making money, especially in real estate. By the 1920s, the conveniently unregulated Massachusetts Trust had become a tax shelter vehicle for rich folks like John D. Rockefeller's brother William, who in 1922 held $7 million in his own Standard Oil stock, and $44 million in tax-exempt Massachusetts trusts. By then, the U.S. government thought that the Massachusetts Trust was just a little bit too good of a deal for investors. Too much private lucre changing hands, again, it seemed. In an eerie echo of the Bubble Act, Morrissey v. Commissioner, the Supreme Court slapped prohibitive tax penalties on Massachusetts trusts, essentially permitting them to be taxed twice. In the late 1950s, one of the largest Massachusetts real estate trusts brought in $519,743 net income, of which federal taxes ate $250,600, leaving only $269,143 available for shareholders. Unsurprisingly, real estate investment plummeted, and by the 1950s, a worried Congress had realized that tax-advantaged investment in Massachusetts trusts might actually have been a good thing for the economy. That's when President Dwight Eisenhower signed the Right Act of 1960 into law, codifying an updated and somewhat more regulated version of the Massachusetts Trust called the Real Estate Investment Trust, right? REITs restored the earlier tax advantage loophole and also added in some benefits like easily transferable shares, meaning these companies could now trade liquidly on the open market, rather than changing hands in back rooms. And, unsurprisingly, they have exploded in popularity, with market cap growing about 17% every year over the past 25 years, and holding about $4.5 trillion in total real estate assets today. Like their direct forebears, the European joint stock companies and the Massachusetts trusts, REITs still function as a big FU to government overreach, and that is perennially appealing. A kind of perpetual motion machine, as it were. In this issue, we are recommending one of the most respected companies dealing with REITs. A safety play with big upside. This month's Complete Investor, formerly The Big Secret on Wall Street, looks at a REIT that has a very low level of risk, and that is supported by a huge dividend that is well above almost any fixed income instrument in the market today. Normally, a low-risk investment like this would offer pretty bland potential upside in return, but the business is at a unique point in the cycle, effectively a trough in conditions that appears poised to move higher in coming quarters. And even if things take longer to turn upward than expected, the dividend yield alone pays investors to wait. This is a rare find in today's market driven by artificial intelligence, AI, fervor. So let's look at an actual positively asymmetric risk versus reward setup. As one of the largest mortgage REITs in the U.S., Annaly Capital Management, NYSE, NLY invests in and finances a broad portfolio of residential and commercial assets, including mortgage-backed securities, MBS, collateralized mortgage obligations, CMO, credit risk transfer securities, residential credit, and mortgage servicing rights. It is a leading diversified capital manager specializing in mortgage finance. Headquartered in New York City, the company strategically leverages short-term borrowings such as repurchase agreements to generate attractive risk-adjusted returns and deliver consistent net income distributions to its shareholders through smart portfolio management and innovative investment strategies. Annaly was founded in 1996 by Michael Farrell and Wellington Dinahan, two forward-looking entrepreneurs in the fixed income world. The company was started with the goal of delivering competitive and dependable returns no matter the interest rate environment or economic conditions. In October 1997, Annaly completed its $102 million initial public offering, IPO, and began trading on the NYSE. Annaly launched as more of a standard issue mortgage REIT, but in 2006 the company changed its name from Annaly Mortgage Management to Annaly Capital Management. That distinction was meant to reflect the evolution of the company from the old pure-play mortgage REIT to a diversified capital manager. That meant diversifying into broader credit businesses and finding ways to offset interest-sensitive cash flows. This change in philosophy has been a key in allowing Annaly to successfully grow over the years. 20 years ago, Annaly's total assets were $16 billion and its balance sheet equity was $1.5 billion. Today the company has total assets of $126 billion and equity of $15 billion. That represents roughly 11% compound annual growth in its assets over the last 20 years and 12% growth in equity. That is quite a growth trajectory over a very long period of time, but to really evaluate it, investors need to think about the underlying dynamics of this business. So how does a mortgage REIT really work? A REIT is a company that owns, operates, or finances income-producing real estate. These companies have tax-advantaged status, meaning they don't have to pay corporate income taxes. REITs can maintain that tax-free status as long as they distribute at least 90% of their income as dividends to shareholders. Those dividends in turn provide a steady stream of income for investors. As we learned above, the REIT structure was designed to make real estate investing more accessible to smaller investors. This made investing in real estate assets like office buildings, apartment complexes, or shopping malls just as accessible as buying stocks. The REIT investor could now invest in these properties without actually owning the real estate. Instead, all those funds would effectively be shared, or pooled, such that each share represented a small piece of the overall pie. A mortgage REIT is a bit different. Instead of generating income on real estate properties owned and managed, the mortgage REIT generates income by investing in an MBS instead of physical real estate. The MBS is a pool or group of mortgage loans or commercial properties. Those loans pay interest, and that interest represents income to the mortgage REIT. The mortgage REIT then uses debt to fund those loan purchases. The company earns the spread between the interest income and its borrowing costs. So the mortgage REIT raises some equity capital from investors, then borrows a lot more in the marketplace, and invests all of that cash in a bundle of loans. But it's not nearly as easy as it sounds. There are numerous risks to the strategy that investors need to consider. One of the biggest risks is credit, and never was that more evident than during the global financial crisis when multiple mortgage REITs went belly up. New Century Financial was the largest U.S. subprime mortgage originator in the mid-2000s, and was the earliest major casualty of the subprime meltdown. Thornburg Mortgage focused on high-risk jumbo and super jumbo adjustable-rate mortgages. That company also got hit by the subprime crisis and filed for bankruptcy. Home Bank Corporation was another mortgage REIT over-leveraged to subprime that went under. But not being primarily focused on lower-level credit didn't necessarily save REITs during this period. American Home Mortgage wasn't even considered a subprime lender at the time. But that didn't save the company from having to file bankruptcy during this period from 2007 to 2009 along with those others. Now it is fair to say that the global financial crisis was a special point in time, but it could easily repeat itself. After all, the U.S. government deficit and debt balances have never been higher. Gold and other hard asset prices have been skyrocketing on the view that higher inflation is here to stay. So an all-clear signal hasn't been given in financial markets. Annaly's different risk levels. In the last 30 years, financial markets have seen some significant periods of volatility. The first was the crisis of long-term capital management in 1998. Then there was the dot-com bubble and economic downturn of 2000. There was the global financial crisis in 2008, and of course the COVID pandemic in 2020. It seems pretty futile to try to predict exactly when the next crisis will be or what will be the trigger, but it does seem like a safe bet to say that investors haven't seen the last of financial turmoil. So how does Annaly differentiate itself to navigate these potential credit pitfalls? Investors should first look at the type of loans it is buying. As of Q3 just reported, 89% of the company's investment portfolio was in agency securities. These are securities with government-backed guarantees. Annaly has $87 billion invested in agency MBS and CMBS securities collateralized by residential or commercial mortgages guaranteed by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or Ginny Mae. Fannie Mae, Federal National Mortgage Association, and Freddie Mac, Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, are government-sponsored enterprises, GSE, that play a critical role in the U.S. housing finance system. They purchase mortgages from lenders, package them into an MBS, and provide liquidity to the market. That process supports about half of all U.S. home loans today. Together, the GSEs back over $7 trillion in assets and help facilitate more than 1 million home purchases and refinances in the first half of this year alone. Both of the GSEs remain under federal conservatorship, which began in 2008 during the global financial crisis to stabilize the housing market. So these entities are controlled by the U.S. government, as has been the case for quite some time. But the reality is, even before that, there was an implicit agreement in place here. The residential mortgages and agency MBS are effectively guaranteed by the GSEs and the U.S. government. That means credit loss rates for investors like Annaly are effectively zero. Because the credit risk is so low, Annaly is able to add a lot of leverage in this business to generate returns. The company looks for a debt-to-equity ratio between 7x to 8x on the agency side of its assets. That allows Annaly to target investment returns of 15% to 17% in this portfolio. It makes sense that this asset class has always been the backbone of the Annaly portfolio, a relatively low-risk and high-return investment for the company. But the company continues to allocate increasing amounts of capital to other areas in an effort to diversify. Annaly has 89% of its investments in the agency portfolio, but only $9.6 billion of capital allocated there out of a total of $14.9 billion. That's 64% of its capital. This is a shift from a few years ago when about 80% of the company's capital was allocated to the agency side. The offset has been growth in the credit business, which historically utilized only 20% of capital but today is higher at 36%. That credit business comprises residential credit and MSRs. Annaly's residential credit portfolio is made up of securities purchased in the open market and held through the Onslow Bay platform. Onslow Bay Financial is a wholly owned subsidiary of Annaly. This platform buys residential whole loans from a network of other originators. It then packages these loans into securities, using securitization as a financing strategy. Onslow Bay controls all aspects of the process, from acquiring the loans to servicing them and setting pricing. That allows for consistent credit quality here. Essentially, this platform is the key operation for Annaly to acquire and package non-agency residential mortgage loans. Today, the residential credit portfolio has $6.9 billion in assets, or 7% of the company's total investments. But with $2.5 billion in capital behind it, that represents 17% of the total capital allocation. Residential credit has much lower leverage on it compared to the agency side, only a 1.5 to 2.5 ratio of debt to equity. But the company can still generate 13% to 16% returns despite that lower leverage. Annaly also uses Onslow Bay to acquire mortgage servicing rights, or MSRs. MSRs are financial assets that represent the right to service a mortgage loan. MSRs are sold by the mortgage originator to another financial institution, which takes over the administration of the loan, including functions like monthly payment collection, setting aside taxes and insurance in escrow, and forwarding interest and principal to the lender. The original lender pays the servicer a fee for providing these services. The borrower doesn't really notice the difference. They simply send their monthly mortgage check to a different address. But lenders will often sell their MSRs simply to free up capital to make more loans. Annaly's MSR portfolio was $3.5 billion as of Q3 2025, or just 4% of total assets. But with $2.9 billion in capital allocated to the strategy, this represents a major commitment at almost 20% of the company's total equity. Despite being relatively unlevered at only 0.5x to 1.5x debt to equity, the company still generates 11% to 14% returns on its MSR book. Annaly has grown to become one of the top 10 agency MBS servicers in the U.S. The company was the third largest buyer of MSRs last year. Perhaps most importantly, Annaly has the lowest note rate of the top 20 servicers in the market. That means these underlying loans have the lowest mortgage rates out there. That's really important, because one of the biggest risks to the value of a servicing portfolio is prepayment risk. If interest rates get low enough, borrowers will look to refinance their mortgages by taking out new loans at lower rates to pay off the older, higher-rate loans. When that happens, the servicing fee stream can go away. Annaly's lower note rate puts it in a superior position to its competitors in this regard. Historically, Annaly also operated a middle-market lending group. That business used to provide debt financing to middle-market businesses, or smaller companies that are often off the radar of many lenders. The business specialized in first lien and second lien loans to these businesses. Annaly also focused on defensive, counter-cyclical industries here. But in April 2022, Annaly sold this business to private equity firm Ares Capital Management, ARCC, for $2.4 billion. That sale was part of a strategic shift to exit commercial real estate and middle market lending to focus on its core housing finance strategy. Annaly is very good at what it does, which is being an expert in the residential mortgage market. It made perfect sense to redeploy this capital into its core competency and get even more focused. The Annaly portfolio is made up of a lot of high-quality residential loans with apparently extremely low potential for defaults. But there are other factors to consider besides just the credit profile. Perhaps the biggest is interest rate risk. Annaly, like any large fixed income investor, needs to consider how moves in rates affect its balance sheet and income stream. Bonds values go up when rates fall and bond values fall when rates rise. And the longer term those bonds are, the bigger the change in value for a given move in rates. The company provides a lot of information to investors regarding interest rate sensitivity of the portfolio. Companies often look for natural hedges in their businesses. That means finding a negatively correlated asset, one which changes in value in the opposite direction of the rest of the business. Some major oil companies also own refinery operations. When the value of oil falls, the input costs for the refinery also go down, increasing the value of the downstream operations. Another example would be how many multinational companies deal with currency risk. By locating their operations in the same regions as where they generate sales, the risk of short-term currency fluctuations can be dramatically reduced. The idea is to mute volatility in the near term but capture value on both sides in the longer term. Predicting the path of interest rates can be challenging, even for the most seasoned fixed income investors like those at Annaly. Annaly's MSR portfolio serves as a natural hedge of interest rate risk. Agency MBS and other fixed income investments that the company holds increase in value when interest rates fall, and decrease in value when interest rates rise, but MSRs have an inverse relationship with rates. MSR values increase when rates rise and decrease when rates fall. That is due to the prepayment dynamic described above. The result for Annaly is a reduction in overall portfolio volatility and interest rate sensitivity. This leads to more stable investment returns across different market conditions. The absolute level of interest rates isn't the only risk Annaly needs to consider. MBS spreads are an important factor as well. That spread means the difference between mortgage rates and treasury bond rates of similar maturities. When spreads are very narrow, Annaly is effectively buying mortgages at rates much closer to the levels of risk-free government bonds. That means less opportunity for returns. Wider spreads to start means Annaly can buy MBS at more of an initial price discount. In considering the future behavior of spreads, it helps to look back at history. In 2008, during the global financial crisis, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates to stimulate the economy. Eventually, the Fed cut rates all the way to 0%. When even that wasn't sufficient to stem the bleeding, the Fed started buying everything that resembled a bond in an effort to ease financial conditions, and that included buying hundreds of billions of dollars of mortgage-backed securities. The Fed resumed this policy during the COVID response, and by late 2021, the central bank owned nearly $3 trillion in MBS alone. However, since 2022, the Fed has been shrinking its balance sheet simply by allowing bonds to mature and not replacing them with new ones. Fed holdings in mortgage-backed securities peaked at around $2.7 trillion and have fallen to closer to $2.0 trillion as of today. Annaly provides data on its portfolio sensitivity to MBS spreads, similar to the analysis on interest rates. That allows investors to think about the potential impact from changes here, but it doesn't really give any insight into which way spreads are likely headed. However, we can make an educated guess. The Federal Reserve's pullback from the MBS market looks just to be getting started. Based on their own projections, Fed holdings in MBS will fall by another $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. Why does this matter for Annaly? The Fed buys MBSs in order to narrow spreads to make funding cheaper, effectively manipulating this market, and they don't even try to hide that fact. But with the Fed now pulling back from the MBS market, private capital will have to step in to fill that void. That means an opportunity for REITs like Annaly to hold an increased percentage of MBS. Reducing the Fed's role removes an artificial buyer who was intentionally propping up the market. That will lead to wider interest rate spreads over time. Without the persistent and artificial bid from the Fed, entry prices for Annaly on MBS will be cheaper going forward, and that means more attractive returns for Annaly on the agency portion of its portfolio. So far, we've covered the asset side of the equation, which contributes to the revenue side of the income statement. But what about the costs or the liabilities that support all this? Annaly funds itself mostly through what are called repurchase agreements. A repurchase agreement is a financing strategy in which Annaly posts assets such as its agency MBS as collateral, then borrows short-term funds against those assets. These agreements typically mature in less than a year, but the average duration of Annaly's agreements is even shorter than that. The vast majority of Annaly's repurchase agreements roll over in 120 days or less. Repurchase agreements typically account for 70% to 75% of Annaly's debt financing. The rest of the company's debt is the securitization tied to Onslow Bay. So Annaly owns longer-term mortgages in the form of agency MBS and other residential credit, and those assets are funded with short-term financing. That means Annaly is essentially borrowing at the short end of the treasury curve and buying at the long end. That makes the shape of the yield curve very important for the company's margins. For the 30 years from 1992 to 2022, the yield spread between the 3-month U.S. Treasury bill and the 10-year U.S. Treasury note ranged between about 400 basis points at the highs and just slightly negative at the lows. The average spread over the period was roughly 200 basis points. Because Annaly earns income on the long end and pays interest on the short end, the more positive that spread is, the more money it makes. But in recent years, this dynamic has been very challenging. Once again, this goes back to the policy of the Federal Reserve since the global financial crisis. The Fed cut its funding rates to 0% in 2008, and short-term rates stayed near zero for most of the time up until early 2022. The Fed felt comfortable keeping rates low for so long because consumer price inflation was non-existent. Further, it seemed as if inflation was permanently defeated forever. But this all changed starting in 2022. Persistent irresponsible government spending coupled with supply chain disruptions during the COVID pandemic caused prices across many commodity products to spike. And it turns out, the inflation genie is hard to put back in the bottle. As a result, the Fed began a persistent rate hike cycle that saw the Fed funds rate move up from 0% in early 2022 to a high of 5.5% by the middle of 2023. And that sent the spread between the 3-month yield and 10-year yield plummeting from just above 2.0% to a low of negative 1.8% by the time Fed funds hit its peak. For frame of reference, that was the biggest inversion of the yield curve since 1981. But rate cycles ebb and flow, and today things are changing again. Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, hit a high of 9.1% in the middle of 2022. Today that is down to 3.0%. Never mind that the Fed's historical target for inflation was closer to 2%. And never mind that prices on an absolute level haven't actually come down for basically anything at all. Investors need to concern themselves with what is going to happen, not what they think should happen. And the reality is that the Fed has decided to cut rates, whether that is prudent or not. U.S. GDP growth was 3.8% in the second quarter of the year. Inflation is still growing at 3.0%, and the current unemployment rate is 4.2%. By any historical measure, the U.S. economy is running hot and the Fed should be raising rates today. Instead, Fed officials are cutting rates and will likely continue to do so. The financial markets see all of this as massively inflationary. We can see this in the prices of Bitcoin, gold, and many other hard assets that have gone parabolic. All of this points to a steepening yield curve, a backdrop in which shorter-term yields fall relative to longer-term yields, longer-term yields rise relative to shorter-term yields, or a combination of the two. That spread between the 3-month yield and the 10-year yield? It has risen from those mid-2023 lows already, but today's spread is still only roughly 0.3%. That is well below that historical average of 2.0% and historical peaks closer to 4.0%. So the bias in terms of the direction of the yield curve certainly appears to be up from here. Why is this important? Again, Annaly borrows at the short end and invests at the long end. So wider spreads mean better margins for the company. And the stock has historically responded in kind. During the yield curve steepening from 2000 to 2003, the ratio of Annaly stock to the broader S&P 500 rose by a whopping 270% over that period. During the yield curve steepening of 2007 to 2009, that same ratio rose by just over 100%. We believe a similar setup is in place today. The rate cycle certainly seems favorable for Annaly going forward, but the key thing to keep in mind is that the company has a long history of managing through both up and down cycles. Again, this business was founded in 1996 and subsequently went public in 1997. Annaly not only survived, but thrived, through every one of the periods of disruption described earlier. That should give investors comfort that whatever unforeseen financial shock comes down the road, management will be ready for it. The trend seems to be the investor's friend in terms of earnings power from here if the yield curve steepens further. Let's walk through what this could look like. First, investors need to know the total assets of the company. Annaly earns a yield on all the bonds it owns, So the more assets the company has, the higher the gross income. Then investors should look at the total dividends paid, accounting for the fact that shares outstanding rise over time due to capital issuance to support balance sheet growth. Now let's consider the yield curve. The shape of that curve effectively measures the margins that Annaly can earn on those assets since the company is borrowing on the short end and investing on the long end. So a simple yet highly effective analysis here is to compare the dividend trend to the average shape of the yield curve. Below is the last 10 years of data in terms of Annaly's assets, the dividends the company paid, and the average yield curve through the year. And this is the ratio of total dividends to assets compared to that yield curve. As hypothesized, the ratios track, and that should allow investors to think about the potential for the stock going forward. Annaly currently pays a 70 cents quarterly dividend, that's $2.80 annualized, or a 13.4% yield on today's stock price of $21. That's a big premium compared to current 10-year Treasury yields of 4.1%, which are comparable to the high-quality agency MBS and other residential securities that Annaly holds. After all, the government guarantees those Treasury bonds, but they also effectively guarantee the MBS. In addition, Annaly stock trades at just above book value right now. That's more evidence of a valuation floor. Back in early 2022, when the yield curve was at historical average levels before the Fed started its aggressive hiking campaign, Annaly paid a 88 cents quarterly dividend, or $3.52 annually. The stock traded at $32 then, representing an 11% yield. This highlights the asymmetry of the risk versus reward for investors from here. As shown above, the company's total assets are about 50% larger today compared to 2022. If the yield curve spread moves back to 1.5%, the estimated dividends per share would be close to $3.50, even accounting for further share issuance. At the prior 11% dividend yield, that would imply a $32 stock price. That's 50% upside from today's levels. But to be conservative, we'll assume the stock only recovers half of the historical gap. That would mean the annualized dividend only recovers to $3.15 per share from $2.80 today, rather than the prior $3.50 level. Similarly, we'll assume the dividend yield only improves to 12.2%, or halfway between today's levels and the 11% level before the last rate cycle began. Even this more modest recovery would imply a stock price of $26, or 22% above current levels. And remember, with a 13.4% current yield, investors are getting paid to wait. That means the total return in the modest recovery scenario is 35%, not 22%. And in a full recovery, that's a total return of around 63%. Not bad for government bonds. This looks like one of the few safe stocks in a very volatile market, with a steady stream of income and significant upside potential. And it has nothing to do with artificial intelligence, data centers, or any of the market hype that has the potential to falter at some point. As we have written here in the past, Annaly is like owning treasuries on steroids, and his looks like a great time for investors to step in. Action to take: buy Annaly Capital Management, NYSE, NLY, up to $30 per share. Porter & Company, Stevenson, Maryland. Thank you for being a paid subscriber to Porter Stransberry's Complete Investor. We hope you enjoyed this audio issue. In addition to this issue, you should check out our best buys where we highlight current portfolio picks that are at an attractive buy point today. You can find the best buys under the best buys link on our site at porterandcompanyresearch.com.